From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, understanding the messaging behind Governor Whitmer's latest public health guidelines.
That a mandate or even financial incentives can be perceived as controlling, and for the remaining vaccine hesitant, that is a particular hot button for them.
Plus, women college athletes on a winning streak despite this wild year.
It's that adversity that has shaped us into who we are and that has brought us together to become, you know, a really united team.
And a Black-led food cooperative gets ready in Detroit's North End neighborhood, partnering with local urban farmers.
This is also game-changing in terms of putting forward another model of economic development, which is based on collective ownership as opposed to individual ownership.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to meet part of the team behind Detroit's new Black-led food co-op opening next year.
As a collective, we will have options that are not available right now. And that's a game changer.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, we have a new set of public health guidelines to talk about. Governor Whitmer announced them this week.
Going forward, fully vaccinated people don't need to mask up anymore when gathered at a residence. And outside the home, masks will only be required in large outdoor gatherings with more than 100 people. But they're still going to be an important part of keeping yourself and others safe anytime you are indoors.
When we first realized COVID may be the biggest public health crisis of our lifetime, Governor Gretchen Whitmer came out swinging. She set up mask mandates, physical distancing recommendations, and more. And she got a lot of respect for that, both within Michigan and around the country. The message now is different. Our guest today is Kenneth Reznikoff, professor of health behavior and health education at the University of Michigan. He's also the chief scientific lead at the university's Center for Health Communications Research. And he's here to talk to us about what's going on in the messaging surrounding COVID. Ken, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April.
For so long, Governor Whitmer was seen as somewhat no-nonsense to the point of picking up the nickname Big Gretch and even experiencing some extreme backlash of her life being threatened around health recommendations that she personified for a lot of people. We're going to talk about what's changing this week, but first, may I ask you how you feel like the early stance that she and the state took during the pandemic, how that plays as a starting block in the process of communicating with Michigan's people about what needs to happen?
I think Michigan in particular was clear and unwavering about the initial behavioral steps of masking, social distancing, and other protective behaviors. So I think the governor and her team from the get-go set out very clear objectives, whereas nationally and in other states, I think there was more mushiness to the recommendations, which I think ultimately hurts their credibility and their uptake.
This week, Governor Whitmer made it known that certain rules would be lifted for vaccinated Michiganders. There are two things about this I wanted to ask you about. There's a chart that the governor's office shared, one with this set of rules for vaccinated people, things that they can now do like attending outdoor gatherings, and then a whole other set of recommendations for people who have yet to be vaccinated. And the state still recommends, if you're in that same group and you haven't received a vaccine, please do wear a mask. First of all, why do you think the governor might be lifting those restrictions right now?
Well, going back to your first question, is this idea of what we call gain frame and loss frame messages. What her chart does is establish both a gain frame and a loss frame. And that's important because different individuals respond differentially to those two types of messages. Essentially, what do you get out of doing this or what do you lose by not doing this? So I think that was smart because that contrast, I think, appeals to multiple audiences. In terms of the broader question, I think people are exhausted. It's very clear that people are waiting for the all clear signal. And the 70% step four is as close to the all clear as our state or the country can give to give people, particularly those who are listening in what we call a peripheral mode. There's two types of message processing, central and peripheral. In central, you get into the details and you might compare how is the 55% step different than the 70% step. In the peripheral mode, you're simply waiting, tell me when it's all clear, and that's all I want to hear. So I think what is interesting is whether or not we'll need additional messaging when we hit 70% to tell people who are only peripherally processing that for the most part, you're close to normal, which is what I think most people are waiting for.
Yeah. At the same time, the governor announced that there have been some changes in the restrictions for testing for athletes who are participating in youth sports. This has been a year when we've seen some parents of student athletes getting really politically involved, trying to encourage the state and local school boards to allow kids to play sports. Do you see the lifting of this testing restriction possibly being aimed at folks who are, you know, who've proved themselves a constituency?
I don't know if I want to try and imbue motive and attribute political intent, but I do think it does send a message to parents who have been asking all the way back to last March, can we please have our kids have normal lives, that it sends a comforting message that normalcy is just around the corner. However, you need to get vaccinated. That's the subtle meta message of all of these rules, is that at least 70% of the people are going to have to do this if you want to achieve that. So there's this very, I think, subtle meta message that, yes, there's good things coming around the corner, but we have to have pretty high rates of vaccinations to get there. And I'm hoping, and I think the governor's office is hoping, that that carrot that is put out in front of you 2 weeks is going to encourage people who are on the fence to maybe get vaccinated.
Ken, what do you make of the shift in Michigan state government messaging toward consent and encouraging people to make their own decisions about these things, rather than just telling them, here's a mandate, you need to follow it?
That's a great question. So the data is very clear that in the vaccine hesitant group, there's really two audience segments. There's the wait and see group, and then there's the what we call the hard no. We have currently mostly hard no's remaining. A lot of the wait and see folks have had their time on the bench waiting, and now they're ready. The hard no group is particularly sensitive to freedom issues, that when you ask them, what are they worried about? Being controlled or feeling their freedoms are being threatened are in their top one or two reasons why they're hesitant. So this idea of saying, this is up to you, this is a choice we hope you'll make, is probably the right idea, that a mandate or even financial incentives can be perceived as controlling. And for the remaining vaccine hesitant, that is a particular hot button for them. So I think it's actually sophisticated to honor choice and what we say volition or autonomy, particularly for the vaccine hesitant group that is the majority of the unvaccinated currently.
A lot of people, in talking about the pandemic, have started to use this term, the consent of the governed. Can you think of another aspect of public health that has, I guess, hung so dearly on this concept? It feels like a first in my lifetime.
Yes and no. So, for example, when Michelle Obama came out with her Let's Go physical activity and diet program, the right went after Michelle Obama for being a nanny stater, for not trusting the American people, for legislating free choice and legislating common sense. So this has happened before. Motorcycle helmets has raised this as well. Gun rights sometimes also raises these issues. So I think this is perhaps the most salient example of our time. But in public health, we have been accused of being nanny staters for many years, of not trusting people's good judgment. And it's a very complicated issue, because if we simply let people follow their impulses, sometimes they might make risky choices that endanger other people. So, for example, driving under the influence, if there were no quote unquote nanny state regulations, people would be more likely to do it. So it is a constant tension in public health of how much to try and legislate versus rely on people's good judgment and free choice.
Ken, this is your field, but are there things that you've learned through the course of this pandemic that you didn't know about how people receive messages about their health?
Tons. From a public health communications perspective, this has been one of the most fast-moving constructs we've ever seen. So just a few months ago, we were worried about, for example, minority groups being hesitant, and people were talking about Tuskegee. And those are very important issues. But that changed very quickly, where that wait and see group started to soften, and we no longer see as many African Americans in that hesitant group. And now what we see is this very concentrated group that we've known about of white male evangelicals, largely Republicans, who are really pushing back on vaccine. And they're not necessarily doing it for what we call the freeloader motive, which is, oh, I'll let other people take the risk. Although that's part of it, there's this philosophical, ideologic pushback against something that, as many Americans have said, this shouldn't be political. But the fact that such a relatively apolitical behavior has become so politicized and connected to religion and ideology is really unique in our lifetime, and has really challenged our ability to come up with messages and interventions, particularly for this tail end of the beast, this highly resistant group. We haven't done enough to motivate them yet.
Ken Reznikoff is professor of health behavior and health education at the University of Michigan. Ken, it's a pleasure talking to you. Hope we can do so again.
Thank you.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state, and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page, or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Next up on the program, we take a little time to note people who've achieved some pretty amazing things in the depth of a completely crazy sports season.
Stay 6 feet away, wash your hands, wear your mask. Oh, at the same time, go practice as hard as you can, because we've got a championship to win.
Our mission as a team was to really do everything in our power to stay safe, stay healthy, and really follow a lot of those guidelines.
One Michigan athlete and one MSU coach are our guests after the break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. That any one of us is getting up and out of bed in the morning can sometimes feel like a miracle. During this pandemic, it can be important to remind yourself to keep expectations realistic. However, this spring, we noticed several of Michigan's collegiate sports teams achieving truly remarkable things, even as they grappled with a host of challenges. And we'll be meeting some of them over the next couple of days. First, you should know that the University of Michigan's field hockey team is on its way this weekend to the NCAA semifinals after sweeping through its Big Ten competition and emerging from quarterfinals last weekend. Claire Brush is one of the team's co-captains. Claire, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can I ask you a question about the quarterfinal that put the team in contention for the next tier?
Yes.
You were playing Bucknell, and there was a moment when two of your teammates, Hallie O'Neill and Catherine Peterson, teamed up for a score that felt really pivotal. Do you remember that moment very clearly? Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So I guess it was a corner play. That's one of our set pieces kind of in the game. And let's see, I am the stick stopper, so it's my job to stop the ball. And I know the ball came out and it was a little bit of a mistrap, but it turns out we've been pretty good at those, where we've really been able to adapt to those kind of plays. And so ended up passing it to Hallie, who was able to get it down with a shot on goal, and KP was able to put it in. And that was a really great momentum shift, I guess, for us. And just in general, we knew we had to get on the board. So that was really a fun play in the game. And it's been fun that we've been able to kind of make the most out of some of the broken plays and kind of play on the fly, even when we have maybe a set plan that doesn't go as we expected it to. So it was really fun.
What was going on with the team when that game ended? Did everybody pretty much just explode?
Yeah, I mean, everybody was really excited. You know, it was a little bit different. Our team has really high expectations for ourselves. And in that game, I don't think we performed quite how we wanted to or quite up to our potential. So everybody was a little bit, you know, shaky on like, oh, like we could have done better, but also really excited because, you know, it's really, really special to get the opportunity to play in the Final Four, especially in a season like this season has been with COVID and everything.
Claire, what has this season been like compared with the rest of your playing experience?
Yeah, so it's been hard in a lot of ways, especially being a leader and kind of trying to figure out how we adapt everything to all the protocols that are going on, the pandemic in general, and just kind of like being a college student and an athlete at the same time. But I think it's that adversity that has shaped us into who we are and that has brought us together to become, you know, a really united team. So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, it could have broken us. It could have sent us all in different directions and we couldn't have been as unified, but we actually really took that as a chance to come together and really like bond together over that and be better because of it. So it's been special in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Around Ann Arbor, it's no secret that young adults have played a role in the pandemic in the latest surge. And I kind of feel like that has to be hard to hear, you know, if you've been doing the stuff that you're supposed to do and trying to be conscientious. Were there very explicit expectations within the team about how public health rules should be handled and how you guys were going to try to stay healthy and stay in contention?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, young people, especially on a college campus, want to be out and doing things. And not everybody has high stakes like we do in terms of what it looks like to actually, you know, have a COVID case on the team, because we're trying to play for something bigger. And half the battle is, you know, getting to the games and playing the games. And, you know, while some of that is out of our control, I think our mission as a team was to really do everything in our power to stay safe, stay healthy, and really follow a lot of those guidelines. And I think, you know, it helps when you're playing for something bigger than yourself and you're not just, you know, focusing on you as an individual, but kind of like it's another part of the team effort in terms of like what it means to be a good teammate. So I think, yeah, as a captain and working with the coaches, we kind of did our best to really like lay things out as clearly as we could and really help each other and hold each other accountable when it came to all that stuff. And, you know, again, I think it was a great chance to like get to be a leader and kind of like try our best to like build respect and all come together in terms of COVID stuff as well.
Field hockey is a pretty high contact sport. Were there ways in which the proximity to others affected your mind when you were on the field? I mean, a lot of us, when we are going out, are sort of trying to negotiate, all right, what's my distance to other people? And then to just have to put that on the shelf for practice or for a game sounds like it's kind of a hard pivot.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So there's a couple things. One, Michigan Athletics and the Big Ten and NCAA has all sorts of testing that's going on. So when we were in season, actually, so like right now, everybody was getting tested once or twice a day, a couple PCR tests a week, and then the rapid antigen tests every single day. So that definitely eases our mind a bit when it comes to that kind of stuff. And then in addition to that, I think one of our main goals was just to kind of be like, let's have our team bubble and let's like be in that bubble and feel pretty safe and comfortable when we're in that. So I think that really helped, you know, of course, like, I mean, it's really nice to have a whole team that you can kind of trust and be with, especially during a pandemic. So I think that's been, you know, something for us to just lean on and appreciate a lot. That certainly helped.
Best pod ever.
Yes.
Who was able to come and watch you play?
So there's a pass list for different games. And often each player gets 4 people that they could bring to the game. And you have to fill it out ahead of time. And that person gets to come and show their ID and come. So for home games, it was 4 people, like I said. So my parents would come. Luckily, once my grandparents were vaccinated, they were comfortable to come also. And I could take some other passes from other teammates. And actually, on my senior day, I got to bring a lot of my family's from Ann Arbor. So I got to bring a lot of them to the game and they got to come watch my last game ever on the Michigan field hockey field. So it's been fun. It's different than it usually would have been, where you can have a lot of the community come into the games. But it's been a nice, you know, more intimate group of parents and close people who have got to come to watch. So I'm really thankful we got that at least.
Claire, was there anything else that was unusual about this year or about this journey to get to the semifinals?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, COVID's changed a lot of it. We wouldn't be normally playing in the spring. I know like a lot of us graduated last weekend on Zoom on a bus ride to Penn State, which has been totally different. You know, usually we're a fall sport, so we're all done back in November. I think a lot of people, like, you know, seniors have had a different time, just kind of like in the middle of a job search while you're in season, trying to do school and finals, and everything's kind of coming together at once. So there's just been a lot going on. And I think, you know, my team's ability to really focus in on what's important and really like compartmentalize some of those things and, you know, do all that has been really awesome. And it's made us as successful as we are. So I've loved every second of it.
Claire Brush, co-captain of the U of M's field hockey team. Claire, good luck in Chapel Hill, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Go Blue.
In other news, the Michigan State University women's golf team last week clinched their 8th Big Ten title, and the team is now preparing to advance to the NCAA regionals. This is a big milestone under any circumstances, but especially for those athletes whose momentum got stopped by COVID last year. Coach Stacy Slobodnik-Stoll joins us now from East Lansing. Coach, good to have you.
Happy to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Was there a point, I guess, during last season when it struck you that because of the pandemic, the team's practices and interactions were going to have to change?
Yeah, it wasn't that they were going to change. It was that they were coming to an end very quickly. And so, yeah, that was a very hard realization. And I think one of the hardest realizations was the most important part of our season was taken away from us. So we did not get to play the Big Ten Championship in 2020. We did not get to go to the NCAA tournament in 2020. That was pretty hurtful to a young group of women who have worked their whole lives to get to this point.
I don't know that you were the one that had to break the news to them. They were no doubt aware of what was going on, but how'd they take it?
Yeah, tough. I mean, I can tell you exactly where we were and what we were doing. And we were actually playing golf at our course. And we got word first that our tournament that we were supposed to leave for the next day was being canceled. And then within a couple hours, the whole season was canceled. And, you know, everyone was in disbelief. And it was like, I've got a few international kids. So for them, it was like, do we get these kids home? Are they staying? Is there any chance that this season is going to start up again? And as we all know, we didn't end up playing golf or sports for a year.
When you did get to the point of having to restructure what you were doing within the public health constraints that everybody's dealing with, how did you go about that?
Well, the guidance was really coming from the athletic department, and that did not happen. Well, we were able to practice a little bit in the fall. We weren't aware that we were going to not have a season once again. So everyone came back and we thought we were, you know, going to be good to go. And then they canceled the fall again. So the constraints in the fall were, you know, it was tough, and it was still, I feel like we were navigating the system that no one was really sure of. And, you know, the vaccine wasn't a thing. And so we did a lot of practicing. We did not get close to each other. We did not go inside. Really the biggest or most interesting part of the team were probably the freshmen. The two freshmen, we have one young lady from Ohio and one from Argentina, and they don't even know where the classrooms are on this campus yet, and they've been here for almost a year. You know, they've never gone to a class, they've never seen the football stadium full, they've never gone to a basketball game. You know, virtually the campus has been vacant, no one's been on campus, and so they have experienced nothing of what college is really like. On the other side of the coin, you've got the seniors and the juniors who are in shock that, you know, this is what their last year or their last couple of years, you know, have been like. And so that was also, you know, shocking for them that this was, you know, you only have so much time in college, as we all know, and they are missing a part that they'll never get back.
From a coaching standpoint, what do you lose when you lose that time in the fall?
Well, the spring and the fall were both hurtful because it takes years to assemble these teams. You know, you have this schematic and this plan of, this one's leaving, this one's coming in, and you know the caliber of the team you have. And honestly, last year we were ready to win another Big Ten championship and get to the national championship and see what we could do. And that's something that we'll never get back. We'll never get that time back with those particular players that were here. You know, we worked pretty hard to get them here and to have that opportunity. You only have one chance per year to win a conference title and to win a national championship. So, you know, that was hurtful. And then the fall, we don't compete. We did what we could. We had our own home tournament with one team that was ours. And so at least tried to give the freshmen some inkling of, you know, what it feels like. We wore our uniforms. We did our team meal beforehand. We made it as real for them as possible within the constraints this fall.
I've got to believe that golf is in a little different place than, say, basketball in terms of how play is affected by what's going on in the rest of the world. Would you say that the bigger thing to grapple with was physical constraints or the psychological things that the team was going through?
Yes. When they came through the gates at the Lash Center, which is our facility, I think everyone would just, you know, let out a sigh of relief because they knew that it was a safe place and they didn't have to worry about COVID. We didn't have to be close to each other. We safely stayed away from each other. We could practice as normal. We could play as normal. And that felt really good and really was a comfort to all of us. Golf has been a comfort to all the team and my family and I. You know, then when they left the gates, it was like, okay, you know, and we're pushing them so hard. Don't be around anyone. Don't do anything. You know, don't, it was just wash your hands. You know, all these rules that they're young people, all they want to do is be around people and, you know, eat in the dorm together and go out to lunch together. And we really tried to hold them back from all those things from a safety standpoint. So COVID didn't get into our team.
You mentioned the fact that ambitions were really high last season, and yet this season, your team didn't just do what they did last year. They did what they did and then some. How do you make the ask of a team to go that extra mile at a time when they're thinking about so many other things?
Well, we have to remember that they are brought here on this campus to be a student first and an athlete second. They know that those are their two jobs. So they excel in the classroom year after year. We've excelled on the golf course for years now. And regardless of what was happening with COVID, as long as we knew that things were going to start opening up and we were going to play starting in February, we had to operate as things were normal. And even though our normal was different, we knew that we still had to get them in that mode to play because their dreams and their goals are the same. Just because of COVID doesn't mean that their ambition and their drive and desire and passion to be one of the best golf teams in the country, you know, had left them or left my assistant and I. It was like, that's all we really felt like, you know, we had. And that's the fun part of what we get to do every day. So asking them to step up and to win another championship is just something that they were recruited to do here. And they know that that's our expectation and that's the standard of this team. It really wasn't that hard. We just kind of had to keep, you know, preaching to them the stay 6 feet away, wash your hands, wear your mask. Oh, at the same time, go practice as hard as you can because we've got a championship to win. And I think that was, again, the fun and exciting part for them is we have the personnel here to do that. And that's why we did it 2 weekends ago.
Not everyone who competes at the collegiate level will have a professional life in golf waiting for them after. But are there ways in which the pandemic has affected some of your team's aspirations or just how they think about where they're headed in other aspects of their adult lives?
Well, I think the pandemic has affected a lot of people, obviously, worldwide. But for my team, what it did is it took away LPGA qualifying school last year. So my senior, Allie Gear, who was from Michigan, one of our best players ever, who chose not to come back for her COVID year, was planning on going to Q school and then did not because there wasn't a Q school. So the LPGA granted 2 years of an exemption to the players that already had their tour cards. So that was something that was quite interesting. And it left a lot of seniors who graduated from college, women college players, kind of high and dry because they didn't have anywhere to play. My team in particular, it didn't affect too much because Poth, my other senior, chose to come back for her 5th year. And now she has a master's of accounting, which is so cool. And then our Japanese player this year who will graduate will go back to Japan to try out for the Japanese LPGA, which is everything's going fine with that over there. So it hasn't really affected too much for future plans. I know things feel like they're kind of getting back to normal. You know, we've traveled since February. We've been on planes. We've been in vans, all with, you know, our safety precautions in place. And we've done quite well. I'm very proud of the team for doing that. And I think with the vaccine, it seems like, you know, things feel like they're getting better.
The regionals are coming up. And I know that there's probably a lot on everybody's minds, but what are you telling the team to get ready?
We're just going through our daily practices. Actually, four out of the five players were just at US Open qualifiers 2 days ago. So they weren't actually on campus for the past couple of days, but today we're at practice again. And tomorrow we'll just be playing as a team. You know, these kids are kind of on autopilot. They know what they need to do. They understand that there'll be 18 teams there. And at the end of Wednesday, we need to be one of the top six to move on to the national championship. And they're poised and ready to do that. And they're peaking at the right time. We played great at Big Tens, and that momentum will just carry us over when we're down in Louisville next week.
Stacey Slobodnik-Stoll, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
In a moment, a new Black-led grocery co-op aims to support both local shoppers and urban agriculture.
This collective ownership model, we think, is a game changer because typically what we see happening in Detroit is development is led by very wealthy white men.
That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For all the dynamic food activists who make Detroit their home, the city is still without a Black-owned grocery store, but that is going to change. The Detroit People's Food Co-op has plans to open in 2022, providing fresh food and more in a planned North End space. The organizers have passed some big milestones lately in their process. We're so glad to welcome Malik Yakini back to the show to fill us in. He's a founding member of the collective that's bringing the co-op to life, and he also leads the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. Malik, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Hanging in. Also with us today is Jerry Hebron. She runs 6 acres of land in the north end of Detroit, the Oakland Avenue Farm. She's one of the vendors who will be providing produce for the co-op and has been involved in other ways as well. Jerry, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start out with a question to you, Malik. You've been in the food space in Detroit for decades, both through the network and D-Town Farms, and all that is adjacent and surrounding that work. Let's talk a little bit about the place that the Commons and that will be the home to the co-op. What structural place you see that occupying in all the work that you've done over the years?
Well, first, let me say that I've been involved in food work maybe for 20 years or so, 21, 22, something like that. I've been an activist for decades, but my activism was not primarily food focused until 21 or 22 years ago. The Detroit Food Commons, we feel, will play a major role in the Detroit food landscape for a number of reasons. One, it's going to be a full service grocery store in Detroit's North End, where right now there's only one option, which is not really a good option. In fact, it's been the subject of some community protests because of the way the customers are treated, and also because of selling outdated food. So there's a huge need in the North End for a grocery store that's full service and sells high quality food. Secondly, it will be a place where farms like Oakland Avenue Urban Farm and other urban farms in the city of Detroit will have a consistent retail location to sell produce at on a scale that has not previously existed. And so we see this as being a catalyst for the urban agriculture movement in the city of Detroit as well. And then finally, the ownership structure is different. And we're very careful in terms of how we characterize the Detroit People's Food Co-op. And we say that it's a Black-led business, but a cooperative is owned by many, many people. And currently there are 1,270 member owners of the Detroit People's Food Co-op. They are not all Black. And so we're careful about characterizing it as Black-owned. That's partially true. But what is totally true is that it's a Black-led co-op. And so this collective ownership model, we think, is also important as a game changer, because typically what we see happening in Detroit is development is led by very wealthy white men. And then the rest of us are supposed to see it as being progress, that they build these edifices that they own, and then we can walk into and spend our money. And so this is also game changing in terms of putting forward another model of economic development, which is based on collective ownership as opposed to individual ownership.
Jerry Hebron, I want to turn to you for a moment. Do you mind telling the story of how you ended up in the neighborhood and how long you've been living there?
Actually, my family migrated to the North End back in the 50s. So I started out living here as a child, and then we migrated to the northwest side of Detroit, which is where I spent the next four decades of my life raising my family, you know, and my, having my career. My mom, who was the pastor of St. John Evangelist Temple of Truth and School of Wisdom, and that's located on Oakland Avenue, right adjacent to the farm, has been the pastor of that church for 35 years. And it was through her request that I came back to the neighborhood in 2008 to actually work and kind of identify with the needs of this community were at that time.
We should say that you served as the executive director of the North End Christian CDC. That was the role
that is true. That is the role that she asked me to fulfill. And it was kind of new for me working in the nonprofit environment because I come from a real estate background. But in any event, the food, housing, and jobs was what was needed. And the church was adjacent to 10 vacant lots on Oakland Avenue. So the community came together, said, we need to have a beautiful spot on Oakland. We can do that by building out a garden with flowers and food and fulfill the need of food insecurity in this community. And so that's really how we started.
What will a co-op in the area mean to your operation?
You know what? That's a game changer. Because as Baba Malik mentioned, there is a grocery store in this neighborhood that was here when I was a child, and my mother wouldn't shop there. And people in this community have kind of become dependent on that grocery store being here and providing the food that they could get, you know? I mean, That's just what was available. The People's Co-op, being in this community, is a new development by Black people, by a Black-led organization. That is huge. The second thing is being able to provide a variety of fresh food options across the scale, grains, all types of commodities that, you know, a consumer can need, as well as the commercial kitchen, the programming. You know, there is a membership charge, but the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, also the People's Co-op, has provided scholarships for community folks who could not afford to pay for the membership. It's exciting, and I can't wait for it to happen.
Malik, you already have more than 1,200 people who have not just indicated they're interested, but have put down some money for a membership to make this happen. This is amazing. Any business owner would love to have so many committed customers before opening even happens. Can you tell us a bit about who's bought in already and who you're hoping will join in going forward?
You know, we really haven't tracked demographically or racially or by age, the people who have joined. So it's hard to tell you. But again, we're expecting to have about at least 2,000 by the time we open the door. And so you label them as customers, which yes, they will be customers, but more importantly, they are owners of the business. And that's the thing that distinguishes a co-op from, you know, a more traditional business, a sole proprietorship or partnership or corporation, that it's owned broadly. And so yes, the 1,270 member owners will be part of our customer base. But we also want to make it clear that you don't have to be a member owner to shop at the store. The store is open to anyone who wants to open that door and come in and see the bounty that awaits them. And so it's both, you know, a community-owned store, but it's a store that's open to anyone, whether you're an owner or not.
Sure. This space, The Commons and the Co-op is a project many years in the making. But now that we're getting closer, there's also this national conversation going on about equity and justice for Black people. And obviously, this is a commanding conversation in Detroit. Could you talk a little bit about how what's been going on in the rest of the country and the community, how that's impacted your plans for opening?
Yeah, so on a couple levels, the events of the last 2 years have impacted us. First of all, with the pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, last March, plenty of people saw on the news empty grocery store shelves, or perhaps experienced that when they went into grocery stores that they shop at. And so many people realized the fragility of the food system. And so I can tell you that I got more calls in March, April, and May of last year from people wanting to start gardens than I've gotten in the last 5 years, because people were looking for options. They saw how fragile the current food system is.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, we saw a surge in the membership, the member ownership for the Detroit People's Food Co-op. We started 2020 in January with 450 members, and that had taken us, member owners, that had taken us from July of 2014 until January of 2020 to get those 450. Since January of 2020, we now have 1,270 members. Secondly, after the police murder of George Floyd and the protests throughout the country, many people in America began to reckon with the issue that many of us have been organizing around for decades now, and that is racial justice in American society, and particularly in regard to policing. But that increased awareness on the part of a broad cross-section of people in America, and that includes foundations, it includes educational institutions, it includes corporations. Everyone, I think, was looking at how they could either actually be more racially just in their practices, or at the very least, appear to support racial justice. But nevertheless, that reckoning was tremendously positive for us also, because we were in a position where we kind of brought together these elements of racial justice and food equity. And so we became much more inviting for philanthropy. And so we saw a tremendous upswing in both donations and in grants that we were able to get in the last half of 2020. And in fact, in the last 8 months or so, we've been able to nail down about $5 million in additional funding from local foundations. And I can almost assure you that would not have happened if it weren't for the police murder of George Floyd and the protests that followed. But the pandemic caused construction costs to go up tremendously. And so the estimate that we got for building the Detroit Food Commons in 2019 increased by $2.7 million by January of 2021. And we still have enough money in place to begin construction. The construction is not going to be halted. But before we open the Detroit Food Commons and Detroit People's Food Co-op, we do have to have a significant amount of money in place that's not currently in place. So the increase of building materials created about a $2.7 million gap for the Detroit Food Commons, which we are working daily to fill.
What a path. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Malik Yakini. He's a board member at Detroit People's Food Co-op. He's also executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And we also have Jerry Hebron, executive director of Oakland Avenue Urban Farms. She will be one of the co-op's vendors. Jerry, you mentioned the fact a little while ago that your prior life was in real estate, and your work in the Community Development Corporation kept you in a place to watch what was going on with that. I wanted to ask you about what you observed in 2008, the last big crisis that most of us now remember. What parallels do you see between what happened then and what's going on right now in the community with the pandemic?
In 2008, the mortgage crisis put me out of business. I literally had to close my office. And actually, I got to say, April 2008 was when the reality set in. But we started seeing changes in the mortgage industry because I also did mortgages in the early part of 2007, not totally understanding what was happening, but the subprime business became the dominant lender, primarily for Black people, people of color. Well, we didn't realize that that was setting people up for failure until the beginning of 2008. And then by October of 2008, I was out of business because the bottom fell out. People started not being able to pay their mortgages and the foreclosure rate excelled. And primarily, it devastated people of color more. And with this pandemic, it's the unemployment rate, you know, the unemployment being the greatest impact on people of color, because a lot of our communities are low income wage earners and they have to go to work. But when these companies close down, you know, many of them didn't have the options that some other folks have. What we noticed is that the food insecurity increased because people were not working, able to work, and housing needs increase. So it's very similar in terms of the impact on people of color, what happened back in 2008.
This is all really catalytic stuff, but it is not the first food cooperative in Detroit. Malik, as we wrap this up, could you maybe remind us of some of the spaces that, you know, set the stage for what's happening today with the co-op in the Commons?
In terms of the history of food co-ops in Detroit, the most recent food co-op that many people are aware of was called the Cass Corridor Food Co-op, which was for many years on the corner of Cass and Willis. They had actually maybe three different locations during the 30 some years they were in existence, but it was a vibrant community institution where people would go to get healthier food options. And that was in a time when the co-op was almost the only place you could go to get things like brown rice and tofu and bulk honey and things like that. But it was also a place where people would go to kind of meet and greet their friends. And so it had a social function too, in the same way that a marketplace and an African society might have. But there were other co-ops. There was a co-op called the 3 for 3 co-op in Highland Park on Hamilton in the 1970s. There was a co-op in Conant Gardens in the 1940s that was run by Black folks. And I'll say even further than that, that outside of Detroit, co-ops have been a tool that Black people have used since chattel slavery ended in order to galvanize our collective wealth and to build power in the face of an economic system which is hell-bent on keeping us out of the mainstream economy. And in fact, the great anti-lynching crusader Ida B. Wells wrote her first anti-lynching article after the three operators of the People's Grocery in Memphis were lynched. And the People's Grocery was a cooperative grocery store. And we still have the same problem. We still have this legacy, continuing legacy of white supremacy and racial discrimination, and a continuing legacy of concentration of capital in the hands of white people. So cooperatives become a means for us to collectively lift up our communities.
Malik Yakini is a board member at Detroit People's Food Co-op. He's also executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. We've also been talking with Oakland Avenue Urban Farms Executive Director Jerry Hebron. Jerry, Malik, it's great to hear your voices, and we're so excited to hear things are moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.